So today we're going to be talking about being all in as it relates to perseverance. That if you are all in on something, then you are willing to persevere in that thing regardless of the circumstances that you find yourself. And by the way, so I was just reminded. Sorry, I'm just going to break in on this a little bit, but tonight, this is just a reminder for everybody. If you ordered your flowers, those mom flowers, please make sure that you pay Bonnie for those today, okay? Because we need to make sure that we make that up. And then make sure you pick up your flowers tonight. And also, we have a bunch of straw. So if anybody wants to buy straw for their house or home for decorations, it's $4 a bale. And you can take some straw with you, and then we take less straw back. So that's a good thing, right? And we'll make sure that we give that to the Chalupiaks who are lending us the straw. So if we can help sell some straw for them, then that's a good thing, I think. So anyway, just to let you know, guys know that. Now, getting back to the sermon. So we're going to be talking about perseverance. Now, I don't know about you, but it would seem as if we're in that time of life, that time in history where there's going to be a need for perseverance in all kinds of ways, right? This year, you will in effect be taking a 15% or 20% pay cut because of the inflation that we're about to experience. And that's going to cause many of us to have to figure out how to persevere financially more, and that will impact people's lives. Perseverance is something that we all need. It's a skill that we have to have. It's an attitude that is essential, and it is no less essential. In fact, it's probably even more important when it comes to our faith in Christ and how we live our faith out in Christ. And so I'm going to be spending some time on that. You'll recall, and it's not here, but the call to worship from Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. Oh, thank you. It should be Hebrews 12. I put that, that's a misspelling, that's a misassignment on my part there, but it's Hebrews 12. Now, it's important to understand about Hebrews 12, where the author of Hebrews says, now therefore, right, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, who's he talking about? He's talking about all the great heroes that they went through in chapter 11, all of the martyrs who lived their faith out for God, who sacrificed their lives. And so he's concluding chapter 11 with this statement in chapter 12. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses who persevered in their faithfulness, which is what he's saying, let us throw off everything that hinders. Everything that would hinder your ability, my ability to persevere, throw it off. In whatever way we need to live out our faith in Christ, if there's something that's hindering that and impeding our ability to persevere, throw it off. Here's the problem. I'm not sure that most of us know what those things even are. So, I mean, we've all gone through life when physically we don't have as much stamina or something's hurting or whatever, and we can't really identify what's getting, or we're fatigued, and we can't figure out what it is that's keeping us from going as hard and as fast and as well as we were before. We just know that we are. Maybe it's a kind of malaise. We don't feel quite right, and so we live with it, but we never identify what it is that gets in the way. Do you know what hinders your ability, my ability, to keep us from running with perseverance the race marked out for us? So in the providence of God, in His plan for our lives, everyone in this room, God has marked out a path for you and me, for you, a path for me, that we have to run with perseverance. And that we have to run that race with perseverance well. And if there's anything that is hindering our ability to run that race well, we need to throw it off. But we have to identify what it is. Do we know what those things are in our lives that are hindering? Is it skill or a lack of skill? Is it an attitude? Is it disbelief, a lack of faith? Is it a grudge, a spirit of unforgiveness? What is it? Is it one thing? Is it multiple things? Most of us here have probably played or participated in athletics at some point. And when we did, the coach would want us to perform at a certain level. And when we didn't perform at that level, the coach would offer, suggest, imply, what it is that you might need to do in order to raise your level of performance for the sport that you were playing. It was hindering you. It interfered with your ability to persevere. So that's what the author of Hebrews is saying here. So I will be reading from 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 24 through 27. Now, to my knowledge, since I've been here for almost 17 years, I've probably spoken on this passage about 3 times. And some of you might remember some of what I said about this passage. Even if you've heard me speak on this passage, and I need to say this very clearly, you need to hear this passage more than you've ever heard it before. You need to engage it in a way that you've never engaged it before. Because the great truth that the Apostle Paul is speaking about here is essential for how you and I will move forward into the future that's going to require more perseverance than perhaps at any other time in the history of our life in regards to our faith. So in Paul's letter to the Corinthians, just by setting it up, he's basically addressing a church that have been shaped by the Greco-Roman culture and found it to be difficult to eliminate that culture from their lives. That culture, the Greco-Roman culture, its philosophy, its worldview, its practices, its values influenced those people in Corinth, and when they became Christians, they were having a difficult time shedding that from their lives. Bad habits, beliefs, practices. But this is also happening as well. Believers in Christ were continuing to be adversely disaffected by the surrounding Greco-Roman culture. So not only did they have things intrinsically, innately within them about how they were shaped by the culture, but the culture continued to pound those new believers in Christ so that it was difficult for them to take on the mind, the attitude, and the person of Christ. That's different than the first one. Does this sound familiar? And that's why the Apostle Paul was addressing them in this way. It's kind of some more interesting things about Corinthians that I hadn't realized until I'd done some more study on it. So in other words, in another letter, in Colossians as well as Ephesians, as well as Romans, the Apostle Paul says, the old self refused to die, and the new self was not encouraged to live as it should. So in that first scenario, those who are shaped by the Roman culture and had difficulty getting rid of those bad habits, he's saying you need to shed the old self. So he says then, in Ephesians, to put on your new self, to put off your old self, which belongs to your former manner of life and is corrupt through deceitful desires, and to be renewed in the spirit of your minds, and to put on the new self created after the likeness of God in true righteousness and holiness. When we do this, then we persevere. When we do this, we throw off all those things that are hindering us from being faithful to God. That's what he's saying here. So in light of believers in Christ, when continuing to be adversely disaffected by the surrounding Greco-Roman culture, in other words, the culture extrinsically keeps pounding us to buy into their worldview, to buy into their values, to buy into their perspective, it just keeps, it's unrelenting. The Apostle Paul says this, that believers influenced by things of the world versus spiritual things of Christ. So he says, do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh and the desires of the eyes and pride of life is not from the Father, but is from the world. And so all of us here are being encouraged to love the things of the world. And if you don't love the things of the world, then you are judged. You are judged. If you do not value what they value, if you don't do what they do, then you're judged. And so are we able to withstand that kind of judgment that the world levels at us because we don't buy into what they want us to love that they love? That list is endless. If I ask you to all to raise your hand and offer one thing, we could, every one of us could say one thing and it would not be the same thing that anybody else said. The list is endless. So when we, again, before I get to reading the text, the poignancy and the relevance of this text needs to be understood before I get to it, because I want you to understand why not only is it important for our context here, but what the Apostle Paul was getting at then. So I just wanted to spend a few minutes on the Corinthian church and Paul's letters to them. You know, some scholars might say that the city of Corinth and the Corinthian church are most reflective of our time. That if you had to pick a church that kind of parallels what the modern day church is in the United States, it's probably the Corinthian church. Probably. They were affluent. They were polytheistic. They were syncretistic. They struggled a tremendous amount with not only different kinds of gods, but also a whole vast assortment of different kinds of sexual sin. Yeah, Bonnie.
What does syncretistic mean?
Syncretism is when you blend faiths together. So, for example, the ruling elite in our culture would say that all religions are basically the same. Isn't it nice that we have people in our culture who inform us the kind of relevancy that our faith has, and that it's really just like Islam, and it's really just like Hinduism, and it's really just like Judaism, and it's really just, all religions are basically at the core the same, we just have different kinds of expressions. No, they are not the same. That's a syncretism. Yeah, no, always ask. Always ask. I'm glad you did. So when Paul is writing to this church that was incredibly problematic, he's writing to them to say, I want you to persevere. I want you to punch through all of these things that are corrupting you, that are calling you to a different thing. You must do that, he's saying. So when we read 1 Corinthians, here are a couple of interesting things I think you might find interesting. So First and Second Corinthians are pastoral books. It's pastoral theology. So, you know how, like, in seminary we have sort of two different kinds of theologies that we study. One is called pastoral theology, the other is called systematic theology. Systematic theology comes from books like Romans, Ephesians, Colossians, Hebrews. Pastoral theology comes from books like 1 and 2 Corinthians, Galatians, 1 and 2 Timothy, 1 and 2 Peter. Basically, it's theology that it's practical theology. This is your issue. This is what God says you have to do. Systematic theology says this is who God is. This is what God requires. This is how you come to salvation. That's systematic theology. 1 Corinthians is more of a pastoral theological book. Now, here's a couple of other interesting things. Luke is the longest book in the New Testament. It has about 19,482 words. Acts, which is a book also written by Luke, is the second longest book at 18,450 words. Now, if I were to ask you, what is the longest epistle in terms of words in the New Testament? Epistle, which means letter. It's 1 Corinthians. It's a pastoral book. It's not a systematic theology. It's not a book about systematic theology. It's a pastoral book. It's the longest book of all the epistles. Guess what's second? Romans. That's more of a theological book. Guess what's third? 2 Corinthians is the third longest epistle in the New Testament. Paul is spending a tremendous amount of ink and time dealing with everyday issues of believers in a church who are having difficulty throwing off those things that are hindering them to be able to run the race that's been marked out for them. And guess what? There probably was a third letter written to the Corinthians that we do not have. Paul refers to it in 1 Corinthians. Paul wrote three letters, a pastoral theology about how this church in Corinth ought to be living their lives. And just so you know what the shortest one is, it's Philemon with 465 words. Don't you think that's interesting? That you have this church that just needs so much of Paul's time and effort, and that church probably resembles our culture today more than any other church in the New Testament that's depicted? So, let's go to 1 Corinthians 9:24 through 27. The Apostle Paul says, "Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training." By the way, that word strict is the Greek word agonizomahi. It's the word that you get the word agony from. So everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They're willing to endure agony in order to participate in those games. They do it to get a crown that will not last. And so you have this comparison contrast thing here where these people are willing to experience agony for a crown. It was a wreath. It was an evergreen wreath that they got at the end of the game. Whatever competition was, it was that. They get it to get a crown that will not last. You get it. But we do it to get a crown that will last forever. We experience, he's saying, as Christians, agony We persevere to get a crown that will last forever. That's what he's saying. Therefore, I do not run like a man running aimlessly. I do not fight like a man beating the air. He's saying, I do all this with purpose, with intent. There's a reason behind all this. That if I'm going to go into strict training and run hard, there's a reason for this. And that reason is to get a crown that will last forever. To live a life of faithfulness, to persevere. I do not fight like a man beating the air, boxing. I do that with intentionality. No, I beat my body, so it's not the same word, but it's the same implication. I beat my body, I experience agony, and make it my slave. I take control of the passions of my life and my body and make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified. So Paul was using this imagery, this metaphor, to help the Christians in Corinth get a picture of how they ought to be living their lives. And he's saying, as believers, you need to exercise and live your life like the Greek athlete, to discipline your bodies, to subject the passions that you have and to suppress them so that you can live a disciplined life with great intentionality and purpose, with accomplishments, that you can throw off everything that hinders so that you can run with perseverance the race marked out for you. Now, the Apostle Paul, Priscilla, and Aquila planted the church in Corinth in around 51 or 52 AD. Paul lived in that city for 18 months. He planted that church. This church that he wrote three letters, two of which we have, he planted that church. It was the Apostle Paul that planted that church. It wasn't me. It wasn't Beth Schaefer. It wasn't anyone like us. It was the second most influential person in the history of Christendom who planted that church and had to subsequently write three letters to get them on track and to keep them there. Because of how they were shaped by the culture and how the culture continued to try and shape them to keep them from running the race that was marked out for them. So while Paul was there, he would have observed athletes training and participating in what were called the Pan-Hellenistic Games, which are second only in importance to the Greek Olympic Games. So it would be like you participating in some kind of national championship here in the United States in order to compete in the Olympic Games. It was that big. And while he was in Corinth for 18 months, he would have observed Greek athletes training and preparing for the Pan-Hellenistic Games. It would have been a dominant part of the culture. It would have been impossible to miss. And not only to train, but to participate. He saw them participate. And so in Corinth and in the Mediterranean basin, like here, sports was everything. People lived vicariously through their athletic heroes back then every bit as much as they do now. We just pay more. He would have watched them compete in a thing called a gymnasium, which means naked school. That's what a gymnasium, that's the word gymnasium, that's what it means. It means naked school. So, in fact, that's why the Jews did not participate in the Olympics or the Pan-Hellenistic Games, because almost anything that you did athletically, you did naked. I'm not encouraging to imagine, but I mean, if you know what I'm saying. So, and I don't think, like Planet Fitness, they had little bottles with cloths that you wiped everything down with when you were done. I don't think that was a part of the equation back then. But the Greeks believed that man was the measure of all things, and that the Greek body was among the most beautiful of all things. And so they celebrated the human body in that kind of a way during athletic games. And so there was built into that was a tremendous amount of accountability. There was a nakedness of living. And you had to be comfortable with that. By extension, within the Christian community, there ought to be more of a nakedness of spirit, where we can be honest and open and transparent with each other. So as the Apostle Paul was using this metaphor, he was writing about the Greek athlete and just using what was really then a meta narrative, a big story that gave the Greeks their identity, their sense of who and what they were. So part of what Paul would have seen as part of the training would be Greek men who were running, who were runners. So when he leveraged this metaphor of training for the Pan-Hellenistic Games, one of the great heroes, ancient heroes of the Greeks at the time was a guy named Pheidippides. And so Pheidippides was known and was a part of the running culture that was a part of the Greek athletic games. And so as Paul is talking about this metaphor of training like a Greek athlete, embedded in that is this image, this person, this icon named Pheidippides. So let me tell you a little bit about Pheidippides. In 490 BC, the Persian king named Darius the Great sought to invade Greece. This is the same Darius the Great that I referenced last week, who said that God raised him up to restore the Jews to Israel so that the temple can be rebuilt. This is the same Darius the Great who is the great-grandfather of Xerxes, the one who released Nehemiah to go and build the walls of Jerusalem. So in 490 BC, this Persian general and emperor Darius the Great sought to invade Greece. And he had a bunch of ships that he had crossed the Aegean Sea. The Aegean Sea is between Corinth and Athens, or Corinth and Greece. And so General Metilides is on a horse looking over this plain in front of him, and there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Persian ships with Persian soldiers disembarking. There are, in fact, 100,000 Persian soldiers. And behind General Metilides are 20,000 Greek soldiers. So there was a 5-to-1 advantage. 5 Persian soldiers for every 1 Greek soldier. Before long, the battle was engaged, and at the end of the day, 6,400 Persian soldiers died to 192 Greek soldiers, one of the greatest victories in military history. The Persians could not figure out the Greek phalanx system. Seeing that they were defeated, they got back onto their ships, and Metilides suspected that they were going to sail around Greece and attack Athens from the sea, which is what their intent was. Wanting to warn Athens, he looked to this foot soldier named Pheidippides, who had just fought the whole day. Not only that, but Pheidippides had run the entire week before trying to get other Greek city-states to join into a confederacy to defend Greece against the Persians. And none of them bought into it, and that's why it was these Athenian Greeks who fought the Persians. So Pheidippides had run the entire week. He fought all day, and Metellus looked at him and said, I want you to run to Athens and warn them that the Persians are going to attack by sea. So Pheidippides stripped down to his birthday suit, and he ran almost 26 miles to Athens. And as he ran through the gates of Athens and down the causeway, he ran up to the city fathers, and as he fell into their arms, he shouted, Nike, which means victory. And then he died. The battle where this, the place where this battle was fought was on a plain called, well, it was on a plain near a city called Marathon. In honor of Pheidippides, the Greeks inserted to their athletic games the marathon race. And that's the origin of the marathon. The word Nike, you know, is the word Nike. So we say Nike, but the Greek word is Nike. And the Nike shoe company adopted that word in honor of Pheidippides and the marathon race. So when the Apostle Paul used this metaphor to encourage and to exhort the Christians in Corinth, he is not only borrowing from this complex of athletic games that everybody would have seen in Corinth, he's also appealing to this phenomenal narrative, this meta-narrative that every Greek would have identified with about Pheidippides. Remember, I do not run as a man running aimlessly. Almost everybody would have thought of Pheidippides. I want you to run like Pheidippides, he's saying. I want you to do what you can do to get other people to fight to the cause for which you were fighting. I want you to fight faithfully when it's time to fight. And then when it's time to warn others and to tell others about the victory that we have, I want you to be able to say Nike. And so the question for all of us is, when we have lived our life and we've run the race that marked out for us, when God says to us, I want you to quit this battle and to go on to this next thing, and I want you to run this race that's marked out, this goal that I have in mind for you, when you and I end this life, will we be able to fall into the arms of God and say, Nike, victory. I lived my life well. I was faithful with what you have appointed me to do. I persevered. I was all in. How will you and I fall into the arms of Jesus Christ? When we enter those gates, when we walk down that causeway, and he wants a report of how we've lived our life, can we say that we will have lived it victoriously, regardless of what is going on? And so that is part and parcel all of what the Apostle Paul was getting at in writing to these troublesome Christians in this very corrupt and difficult place called Corinth. These Christians who just kept wobbling back and forth. And the Apostle Paul is basically saying to them, I want you to persevere. I want you to punch through and to be faithful. Will we be able to do that? Are we willing to be all in, enough to persevere faithfully, regardless of the circumstances? And so I'm just going to spend a few more minutes talking about this. I want to be very clear about something. From the prophets of the Old Testament to the apostles in the New Testament, it's always God's revelation. I'm sorry, it's always about God's revelation addressing the fallenness of world and culture and of human conduct associating with it. So I wasn't very articulate the way I said it because I was trying to read it and I wanted to say it differently. But I want to say this. When you read the Old Testament and the prophets, when you read the New Testament and the apostles, whatever critique they have, it is rooted in the culture and it is rooted in the world. I've had people over the years say to me, I don't think it's right that you include the culture and your critique of culture. You should just be speaking about the Bible and what God has to say. And I will say to them, examine the Old Testament, examine the New Testament, because any critique that's there, whatever critique it is, finds its rootedness, its causation of for what is going on in the world and at the culture at the time. The world is physical and it exists in real time. Culture does not evolve from nothing. Human behavior cannot be informed or shaped without social forces surrounding it. Do you see what I'm saying? You, everyone in this room, as well as myself, are products of this world and this culture that we live in. And not only that, but the way in which we live our lives, we contribute to the culture that in turn informs and shapes other people as well. So if there's an issue within the culture that needs to be addressed, we address it. Because it shapes how people live, what their values are, how they conduct themselves, all of those kinds of things. So within our own culture, every major cultural institution exists now in a post-Judeo-Christian worldview. At one time, government was informed by the Judeo-Christian worldview. At one time, higher education and secondary education were informed by a Judeo-Christian worldview. At one time, even the media, the fourth branch of government, was informed by the Judeo-Christian worldview. For most of Western civilization, the arts and whatever pop culture existed at the time was informed profoundly by the Judeo-Christian worldview. Have you ever heard of Handel's Messiah? Have you ever looked at some of the great artists who painted and sculpted? Social media, on the other hand, which is clearly an institution in the culture and maybe perhaps the most powerful institution in the culture, has never been influenced by the Judeo-Christian worldview. All of these things here profoundly shape the world in which you and I live. They are what determines what should be valued, what should be loved, how we should act, what our behaviors ought to be. Will we be the kind of people that have the ability to live within that kind of an ethos, that kind of a culture that's post-Judeo-Christian worldview? Will we be able to persevere in that? So look, just going back over that real quickly. A recent administration, not the most recent administration, but the one prior to that, litigated against the church more times than all other administrations in the history of our country. Litigated against the church to get the church to get it to do what it wanted the church to do. We won most of those. But one administration litigated against the church by far more than any other in all other administrations in the history. In higher education, there's an interesting article by a guy named Rod Dreher, who is one of the, I think, premier cultural critics, Christian cultural critics of our time. In that article, he discusses how faculty in higher education can never mention that they are Christian because they will not get tenure. They might lose their job. They may not get funding. They are considered to be pariahs in the world of higher education. Christian students are not accepted into certain colleges, may not be accepted into med schools if they note in their documentation that they are Christians. Remember when this country started that our premier institutions, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, were presided over by men who were pastors and theologians. Today, the overwhelming percentage of presidents of our premier universities and otherwise normally have degrees in social science. 95% of those people in social science are not believers. I don't want to say 95%, but they lean far left. The legacy media. So the last time I saw a pastor presented favorably in a movie was Clint Eastwood's Gran Torino. I can't remember a positive presentation since then. I can't remember a positive presentation for decades before that in any major well-regarded film. I can't recall one. Now, when I look at some TV programs, I see where Satan actually visits the earth and exerts justice on behalf of people who are being oppressed, and I see pastors and people in churches who are the ones that are really evil. I mean, there's been a complete switch. I'll say this, in terms of social media. I can almost promise you that within 10 years, much of what I said so far this morning, within 10 years, will no longer meet community standards on social media. And that things like what I said this morning, as well as things that I've said prior to this, will be regarded as being too offensive to be maintained on most social media sites. That's why churches like ours cannot become dependent upon social media. Our congregation cannot be just out there. Our congregation has to be here. We cannot be dependent upon social media platforms that can pull the plug anytime they want to. So I have more that I wanted to share about this that I do not have time to get into, but I just want to conclude by saying that we live in a time where what is going on must get our attention. And to use a biblical term, do you know what the term gird your loins means? Do you know what that means? Do you know the Israelites used to have long, like, robes that they wore? And that when they fought, they would pull the robe up around their legs and tie it so that they could move unencumbered? That was called girding your loins, so that you could move more effectively. Because you knew that you were going to have to persevere in the battle you were about to fight, and that's what you would do. We are in a time where I think that is increasingly true. So I'm asking you, are you willing to do what is necessary to persevere? Do you understand that more might be required of you? Let me just say, just real quick by way of example. This became clear to me after I began to see a difference, but once I went to the grocery store and bought some gas and bought a few things, and I realized how much more I was paying for everything, I began to think, I have people in our church, and they're going to have to pay a lot more for things. And I began to wonder, what's that going to do to our budget? What's that going to do to our ability to persevere as a church? Will that because if it impacts you, it's going to impact us. And because I knew it was going to impact me, and I should probably tell you this anyway, just this past week I got a small part-time job so that I could absorb and persevere. So I try to get out in front of it so that I can be prepared because I know that things are going to get pretty tight. And I want to be able to persevere. And I know you want to do that as well. And I know that we have to do that as a church. So just by way of example, one of the immediate ways that we're going to have to persevere is what may or may not happen to us financially as a church. Which in part is why I really need you to make that commitment. That and other things. Today, we're going to have people. We've had as many, I don't think we'll have as many today, but we've had as many as 300 or 400 people on our property when we had our Family Fall Festival. We need to persevere in that way in terms of reaching out to people and encouraging them to become a part of our church community and our family. We need you to do that, to help us with that. So I'm kind of tailing off because I had other stuff here and I'm kind of tailing off, but I just wanted to say that I want to be that guy. I want to live my life where I fought the fight and I ran the race that God has marked out for me. And at the end of the day, I want to be like Pheidippides. I want to run through the gates of heaven. I want to run up to the throne of Christ. I want to be able to fall into his arms and to be able to say with all sincerity and all truth, Nike, I live my life. The one life you give me. No redos. Just this one, but I've lived my life faithfully and hard. I ran hard and I ran long, and I can say with all sincerity, Nike, victory. I live my life in victory. Do you want to say the same thing? And do we want to say that about our church as well? I hope that you do.